And everybody has been muted. You have the ability to unmute yourself. Please feel free to do so if you have any comments or questions, or you can enter them into the chat. So welcome all to the Star Wars Day edition of Q&A. The next week's meeting, just a reminder, we're going to be having that. I pasted it into the chat as well, and it's on the website. Gillian Villeneuve from the Macintosh User Group of Ottawa will be coming out to talk to us about her MacBook Pro. And so that should be an interesting evening. We've never had a presentation on the Macintosh, so hope everybody can turn out for that. Other major announcement, I guess, is that the third of our Tech Talk series is coming up on first Monday of June, which is June the 6th, and it'll be Lawrence, who I believe is on the call tonight. I don't see him. So Lawrence, he'll be giving his presentation on scam avoidance and trust. So we got a lot of material. So Alan, take it away.
Okay, thank you, Chris. Yes, we have a fair number of things to go through. So first of all, I've got a short thing on smartphone basics. A couple of the questions that were on the list of 20 questions, pretty easy to answer. How do I take a picture and how do I take a video? And the answer is you need to find the camera app. Now, my phone, I have it tucked away on the bottom left-hand corner there, so it's easy to find. So basically, you just load the camera app, point the phone at whatever you want to take a picture of, and the big white button there on my phone, and you press that, and it takes a picture. Now the problem is finding the pictures where they're stored, and they could be stored all kinds of different places. A neat thing, though, on my camera app, this little icon down here actually loads the folder that has the last picture that you took, so you can check the properties on that and see where things are. And notice also that we've got a bunch of options here. In addition to photo, we can take videos, and we've got portrait mode, and we've got something called fun. So clearly, if we went to video, basically the same kind of thing. You point the phone and press the button now that has a red dot in it, so it looks like a VCR record button, and that will record the video. And once you're finished, it's a toggle, so you hit it again and it will stop it, I believe. Remembering Linda's presentation last week about the Pixel Pro and all the fancy cameras and stuff she had, my phone has a few. It has three cameras with different kind of lenses, and you can see here if I hit one of these little buttons, I get a choice of 0.5 times, which is a wide angle, up to 10 times, which is a telephoto. And then the other interesting thing, that fun mode button, I actually have seen hot air balloons out of my back window, but I've never seen the other guy on the right-hand side here. So I'm not sure what you would do with pictures that you take in the fun mode like this, but something to experiment with, I guess. Well, that's how to take pictures and videos with smartphones. And now Chris has got a question about calendar files. Except Chris has muted himself.
Thanks, Alan. So this is something that's pretty common if you go to register for some event or set up a meeting or something like that over the web somewhere. You get an option to add it to your calendar. And one of the ways that it can be added to your calendar is through what's known as an ICS file, which gets downloaded to your computer. Question is, what do you do with that ICS file? And Bob found that if he double-clicked on the ICS file, it wanted to add a calendar item to Microsoft Calendar. If you have Microsoft Office installed, it might want to add a calendar item to Microsoft Outlook. Next. So he wanted to know because he's a Google Calendar user, how can he actually double-click an ICS file and get it to create a calendar item in Google Calendar rather than Microsoft Calendar? Next. So the ICS files came out in 1988 from the Internet Engineering Task Force. They created this iCalendar file format. And it's a plain text file that contains information about calendar items. So it will have typically title, summary and description, start and end times, usually in GMT, the location for it if that's been specified, an alert trigger so you can have it that the sender might have set it up so that you'll get reminded 15 minutes beforehand about it or something like that. And most calendar programs out there now should be able to accept ICS files. Next. So how do you set defaults for a file? Well, you go to Settings, Apps, and Default Apps. And if you look there, there are default apps in categories for email, maps, music player, photo viewer, video player, and web browser. And there's nothing there about calendars. Next. But you can choose a default application by a file type as well. So if you click on that, it'll bring up all of your file types that are registered with Windows. And if you scroll down to .ics, it tells you that it's an iCalendar file, and it allows you to choose your application. And you can choose Calendar, Outlook, and look for a new application in the store that'll handle ICS files. Clearly, none of that was going to help. So next. So the problem is that web-based calendars, such as Google Calendar, typically you can't associate them with an ICS file because it's really the web browser as opposed to your Google Calendar within the web browser. But you can still import them. Next. And so if you go into your Google Calendar and you click on the gear icon in the toolbar, and then you go to Settings, and then you'll get Import and Export options. And if you click on Import, there will be a bar there that you can click on to select a file from your computer. And then you navigate to wherever you saved your ICS file that was downloaded to your computer. Typically, it would be in your downloads directory. And then you get returned to the previous screen with the gray bar now showing the ICS file as being imported. If you have multiple calendars that are being displayed, you can choose from a drop-down list what calendar you want this item to be added to. You click on import, and you will get a dialog box saying imported one of one event. You click on OK, go back to your calendar, and the calendar item has been imported. So it's a little bit of a tedious process, but it's usually better than manually entering the information, where you have to put in start times, end times, and the URLs it's at, and all that sort of thing. It's fairly straightforward to go through, and so that's how you can deal with ICS files in Google Calendar.
Jocelyn wants to know, can the ICS be used with Thunderbird's calendar?
Thunderbird's calendar is going to be an application. So I think Thunderbird's calendar, if I'm not mistaken, is a separate app. It's a Sunbird or something like that, they call it. And if that is installed as a separate application, I would be willing to bet that it steals the association for .ics so that it will open up. If not, there probably would be an import capability in it. But Tom pasted in something about Mozilla questions, so I presume it's on there.
Yeah, so, Bob Walker here. If you choose select app by file type under ICS, if you have Thunderbird installed, it's one of the selections.
Oh, okay, cool.
And I guess in a roundabout way, if you have your Thunderbird link to your Gmail account, you can sort of sneak it into your Gmail calendar that way.
I'm not sure you can associate Thunderbird's calendar with your Gmail calendar, can you? I've never actually tried it. Yeah, I haven't tried it. The only thing I use Thunderbird for is email, and certainly for email you can set it up as POP or IMAP. But I don't know if you can – that'd be interesting to check out to see whether you could actually do that or not.
Just a little note about the calendar in Thunderbird. It is now integrated in the same application.
Okay. And yeah. As Bob noted there, that it is – so you can select it as a file type. So if you go back a couple of slides, Alan. Another, there. Sorry. Oh yeah, one more. Go back one more, yeah. And there. So, yeah, where you have choose an application, it sounds like if you have Thunderbird installed, it will show up there. And so it can be associated with Thunderbird's calendar. And then if you double click an ICS file, it will open up in Thunderbird. The issue really revolves around the fact that it's a web-based calendars. It just, there's no way to associate it with the web-based calendars. But if you have a separate application, then it should be able to be associated with data, the ICS associated with that particular application.
There was a question, Chris, about what does ICS stand for, essentially?
Internet calendar is the closest that I've come to, and I don't know what the S is all about.
You need three for an extension, maybe.
Well, you don't, but I assume it means something. But when I looked at the information on .ics, all they ever said was it's an iCalendar file. Mm-hmm. That's all.
Maybe it stands for system.
Who knows?
Yeah. Okay, thanks, Chris. Talking about Thunderbird and email and all things like that, I actually have a problem with my email. It suddenly decided it was going to reject any mail that I tried to send to users with simpatico.ca addresses. And you can see here where it's, I'm getting a mail delivery fail message. All hosts at simpatico.ca have been failing for a long time and the retry time not reached. Here's the actual headers and stuff. And basically my ISP is Bell Canada. I've got this IP address from Bell. My outgoing server is actually Tuny Hosting. That's my web and mail server hosting service. Any recipient at simpatico.ca gives me the problem, and I'm actually using Thunderbird. So the problems are that all of the simpatico.ca addresses are rejected. However, I'm sending mail and receiving mail as usual from everybody else and to everybody else. And it's a very recent problem. I've been sending mail to Simpatico users for years without any problems. And I haven't changed any setting on my system. So it, as far as I'm concerned, it ain't me. So I go and ask Tuny Hosting, and they tell me that, well, there's a 554 access denied error, and it's my IP address which is being blacklisted, which is the Bell Canada IP address, remember. And the issue is not with Tuny Hosting, and therefore it must be a Bell problem. So I get hold of Bell, and they tell me, well, you're not using Bell.net, so go away and don't bother us. And Thunderbird settings are probably the problem, except I hadn't changed any of those, remember? They tell me that my IP address isn't blacklisted, and so the problem is clearly at Tuny Hosting. So we got warring IT providers. Well, my IP address is blacklisted because if I check on the web on some sites that I can type in my address, my IP address, and you can see here's a couple of places where they're noting that as being blacklisted. And here's another DNS checker, same kind of thing, a whole bunch of things. A lot of them are not blacklisting it, but two or three actually are. So I don't know if anybody else has ever run into this kind of a problem. And Chris suggested just switching outgoing servers. So I could use Gmail, or I could actually use my BellNet account as an outgoing server. And actually, that's what I'm doing right now. But, you know, if it's my IP address, which is blacklisted, I'm paying Bell to provide my IP address. And I'm paying Tuny to give me mail and web hosting services. So it strikes me one of them should solve the problem for me. And the 554 error, as Chris points out, that basically just says, there's a problem. It doesn't tell you anything about what the problem is. So if anybody's got any bright ideas, I'm open to suggestions. Anything?
Tom suggests you can ask blacklisters, don't block you. Unfortunately, there's a lot of blacklists out there, and typically the 554 error doesn't tell you who it was that actually blacklisted you. So that can be a real problem. And there's a bunch that will just ignore you because they figure, well, the spammers will try to get off the blacklist too. And so it's very difficult to get off blacklists in my experience of running a mail system for Natural Resources Canada. It can be a real problem. Alan, you say that you are currently using Belknap.net mail server?
Either that one or Gmail. I forget which one I set up.
Oh, okay. Because if it's the Bell one, then obviously it's not Bell that's the problem. Obviously it must be Toonie, because if it was Bell, you would still have the problem.
Yeah, that's right. I tried that. Actually, I did send an email from Bell.net using the Bell.net server to a Simpatico address, and it got through. So then I said, well, the IP address can't be blacklisted.
I think it's got to be the Toonie. It's got to be the Toonie. Theoretically, it could be your personal IP address. But if that was the case, then that wouldn't have been solved by moving it to any other server. So if you moved it to Bell as the mail server and it's getting through, but it's not getting through when Toonie is the mail server, then it's got to be Toonie. That's the problem.
Okay, so I'll go back to Toonie. Maybe I'll get a different agent and a different answer.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks, everyone. And now we've got another question about Gmail on Chromebooks, I believe.
This was driving me nuts for the longest time, and it was originally working fine on my Chromebook, the Gmail app on the Chromebook. And I really like it as opposed to using web-based mail on a Chromebook because of the low-resolution device. It's a really cluttered interface to use the web-based mail. So all of a sudden what was happening was if I did a reply or a reply all or a forward to any existing email in my mailbox, it opened up, rather than a reply or a forward, it opened up a blank compose window and had nothing in the to, nothing in the subject, nothing in the body. So as a workaround, if I was replying to mail, I would actually switch over to the web-based Gmail to do the reply, and that was fine, except I consider it to be almost useless because of how cluttered the screen was, and it was a real pain in the butt to have to switch over to another interface just to do a reply to an email. So I was rather peeved at it. And next. So I complained using the in-app feedback function. So on the Chromebook, there's every app on there. There is an in-app feedback function which will go to purportedly the developers. I got no response. I reported it a couple of times in there and no response on there. I went to support.google.com and I found many posts there complaining about exactly the same thing. Useless advice from the developers, while developers or whoever is administering the support.google.com forums, they had useless advice. So it was just, you know, stuff that didn't apply at all. And no admission that there was actually a problem at all. And so I did find just yesterday a solution from one of the forum users at support.google.com. They found that if on the reply button, if instead of hitting, just clicking once on the reply button, as one is wont to do, if you double click on it, it will actually open up a correct reply window with the subject and the to already filled in correctly. The one little wrinkle on there is it looks like the body is blank, but there is an ellipsis there. And if you click on the ellipsis, the entire original message shows up. And so it works. I just have to remember to double click, or I have to back up and do it when I forget to double click. And I'm still hopeful that a proper fix will come to the app, because I don't see any reason why they shouldn't be responsive to this. But until such time as that happens, I have a working solution. So if anybody is using the Gmail app on a Chromebook and is running into this problem, there's your fix.
And as Tom says, double click, crazy.
Yeah, I don't know who discovered this. I would have never thought to double-click on the reply button. Now, one thing that this doesn't work for is I can't double-click on the reply to because it's in a drop-down. Actually, I haven't tried, but the reply reply all and the forward are on drop-down lists rather than a button. So I don't think I can double-click on them, but I can live with this.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And moving along, I have a question, another question.
One more comment on that, your IP address being listed. You could also try unplugging your modem overnight and get a new IP.
Oh, see, yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah, I should try and do that. And Ed says, this may actually be a feature and not a bug, Chris.
Yeah, right.
Because we didn't tell anyone.
Yeah.
Okay. yeah, this seems to be the week for weird problems. I got a laptop from a friend. It's a two-year-old Dell laptop, but Windows 10 is broken. And when I say broken, it's really broken. I don't have time right now to go through chapter and verse, but if I get it fixed, I may come back to this. But for example, if you left click on the start menu on Windows 10, nothing happens. If you right click on the start menu, you get the regular context menu where you can load device manager and things like that. But then there's a whole raft of other stuff that's bad. And one of the problems is that the hard drive is encrypted with BitLocker. And my friend doesn't know that, but I can't find a way around it. My friend doesn't know that BitLocker is installed, and she also doesn't know the password that will disable it. If you check on the web, then Microsoft tells you that, well, you can recover the BitLocker key using your Microsoft account. But the trouble is, her Microsoft account, which was one of the Hotmail accounts, was hacked. And the password that she has doesn't work. So I suspect that the hacker may have changed the password. And it turns out anything I try to do to, do a boot repair or a troubleshoot or almost anything like that, and the first thing it wants to do is unlock BitLocker. And I can't do that. So it looks like my only option is to do a completely fresh install of Windows. But it won't let me do that either. If I download the installation media from Microsoft, the ISO file, and create a bootable USB, when I boot the USB, BitLocker kicks in and wants to be unlocked before it'll do anything. So my question is, has anybody ever started with a brand new disk? So let's say I blow away all the disk partitions on this drive. And have you started with a brand new disk and installed Windows using this installation USB? Is that going to work for me? I don't mind trying it because I've got a disk image of the system, the broken system, which I can always restore. But I just wondered whether anybody's done it and can tell me that's going to do the trick.
I haven't done it, but I presume that would be a doable thing. It should just see it as a blank disk and allow you to do the install. And it should activate automatically because the hardware hasn't changed. So it should be no problem on the installation.
Edward says he's done a clean install on a newly installed SSD. So that's equivalent, I guess. So yes, it should work then. Good. All right, thank you. I'll report back. Yeah, you need the Win license. Well, maybe. Sometimes you don't, it turns out.
Hello.
Okay.
Maybe it was a few weeks ago I gave some instruction to restore Windows 10. I wonder if that could help you also in that case.
What was that, Jocelyn, again?
A few weeks ago, I did give a list of instructions how to restore Windows 10, and it's fairly simple, but it takes a long time. That may help in your case also. I don't know.
Is that using the installation media?
No, it was some instruction. I can try to find them again if you want.
If you're doing it from Windows, it ain't going to work because I can't get rid of BitLocker.
Yeah, that's going to be your problem.
Yeah, Bob Walker here. I believe the Windows key is stored in the BIOS and not on the hard drive. Because I've taken out the C drive, replaced it with a solid-state drive, and had no trouble installing Windows 10 because it recognized that that particular computer had a Windows 10 license.
Yeah, me too. I've had the same thing. So, although I do actually have the Windows authorization key, that's not a problem. So, okay, all right. Next, we have that voice from the past there, Bob Walker. You're up.
Okay, let me just share the screen here.
It's up.
No. He's going to share his screen.
Okay, do you see the May the 4th be with you?
Yes, we do.
Okay, so today is May the 4th, so May the 4th be with you for all you Star Trek fan or Star Wars fans. Okay, so tonight I'm starting a new presentation mini-series, and it's focused on videos and audios and ways to download them. Or capture them off your screen, or take screenshots, and later on we'll look at turning your CDs into MP3s and how to edit the tags on your MP3s so that your music player will display all the right information. The series is going to focus on using the various software tools at a basic level. I'm not going to get into advanced stuff on any of this. We're just the basic level of functionality to get the job done. A lot of these tools have functionality that's way beyond what I'm going to cover. And if you want to try it, you can go and play with them and have a great time. There's some overlap in functionality between the current versions of the various tools we'll be looking at, because I started using some of these tools a few years ago when their functionality was much more basic. The tools I'm going to be featuring may not necessarily be the very best for a particular task, but they'll get the job done. And as much as possible, I've tried to select tools that are free or that at least have a free version available for you to try out. So tonight we're going to cover how to download videos and audio from YouTube using Video Download Helper. Video Download Helper is an extension for the Firefox and Google Chrome web browsers. It allows the user to download videos or just the audio portion of the videos from sites like YouTube that stream videos using several different technology formats. The Video Download Helper does not work on all sites and does not necessarily get all of the videos in any particular site other than YouTube. So we'll cover how to get these videos in future sessions. This is a list of just a few of the sites that Video Download Helper works on. Starting with YouTube, and I'm going to feature using a Video Download Helper with Firefox. And the reason I'm doing this is Google owns YouTube, and one of Google's prime missions in life is to make you live your digital life in the cloud so they can track your every move. So the functionality of the Google Chrome version of Video Download Helper is sometimes blocked by Google. And so I'm going to focus on the Firefox version. You may recall on my earlier series on privacy on the internet, that Firefox is one of the better privacy-oriented browsers, while Google Chrome is at the other end of the privacy spectrum. As of December 2019, Video Download Helper is the third most popular extension for Firefox, after AdBlock Plus and uBlock Origin, and it's the second most popular Mozilla recommended extension with almost 3 million users. Mozilla is a company that makes Firefox and Thunderbird and several other things. Now, I understand there's also an Edge version of Video Download Helper available as well, and my reaction to this was sort of like, meh, because I'm not a real big Edge fan, but you might want to try it out if you're a regular Edge user. So why do you want to download videos and audios? I mean, they're readily available online, right? So why bother to download them onto your computer? So what about when you're not online for whatever reason? You're up at the cottage, you're on an airplane, and you don't have internet connectivity. The video that you see online today may not be online and available tomorrow. I got a few great videos that I downloaded a few years ago, and you go to look at them again on YouTube, and they're not there anymore. If you're looking at the video on YouTube, a lot of time, well, you almost inevitably, unless you have the premium version of YouTube, have to suffer through some ads at the beginning and sometimes at the end. And on longer videos, you have to suffer with ads in the middle. The downloaded videos don't have any ads. Quite often, you can find music on YouTube that you can't find on iTunes or elsewhere, especially if you're after a rare version. This can be quite valuable. I've gotten several tunes off of YouTube that in versions you just can't get anywhere else. As well, you might want to group the videos you download with other associated files. For example, you're building a directory or collection of videos, audios, stories, and other material on a particular artist you like maybe Adele or U2. You might want to group the videos together with other instructions on how to fix your 1996 Honda Accord or restore your 1970 MGB or how to make PowerPoint presentations or how to install a water softener or as part of a collection of recipes and cooking videos. And I've done all of these things, so it's good to have. Now, as much as Video Download Helper is an extension for the web browser, there's a converter app that's associated with it. And it's an external program installed on your computer that is called up in the background. Like it's not apparent to you. It's all done in the background. To perform operations could not be carried out from a browser extension. And the converter app is required in three situations. One is what they call aggregating audio and videos. A lot of the online videos on YouTube and elsewhere are not on YouTube as a single file, but instead as a separate video file and an audio file. And when you look at the video on YouTube, your browser automatically puts them together for you, so you're not aware that they're separate. But if you go to download them, you need what they call an aggregator to take the two or three or four separate files and aggregate them into a single file. Video Download Helper can also convert the video to a different video format as it downloads the file, and this includes downloading just the audio portion of the video, which is something you might want to do if you're looking at a video for a particular tune or song. And converter app can also convert files that you've already downloaded into a different video format. I don't recommend this, and I'll talk about more about that a little bit later. Video Download Helper itself is free, and it doesn't require any registration. An unregistered version of the converter is free, but the registration only costs about $16, and it's usable on a reasonable number of computers. Because the developers have to eat too. They don't do all this work for nothing. Now I've found that I've actually installed the converter license on four or five different computers without any grief. However, if you don't pay for it and register it, the converted videos will have a QR code on the video. You won't be able to convert videos directly to MP3 audio files. You won't have any access to support for the conversion feature. And there's a restriction. You can only download a file every 2 hours. Here's an example here. This is Adele's Easy on Me video at the NMA Awards. You can see the QR code in the upper left-hand corner. Any of the videos that I downloaded way back in the past before I ponied up the money for the converter app, I've since downloaded it with the converter app and gotten rid of it, but some of them had a QR code like the yellow outlined box you see there that takes up a big part of the screen and can be very annoying. Because the Video Download Helper is a browser extension as opposed to a regular application, and then it has an application associated with it, we're going to have a quick look at how to install it. Basically, you open up Firefox, and you click on the hamburger menu in the upper right corner, and then it'll open up, and you click on the add-ons and themes line. The screen that opens up, you click on extensions, and then you enter Video Download Helper in the Find More Add-ons search box, and then you hit enter. You get this sort of screen coming up, and Video Download Helper may not necessarily be the first selection, but you click on the Video Download Helper selection in the search results. And you get a screen coming up like this, and you click on Add to Firefox. That'll bring up the screen I'm showing now. And this indicates that we've installed Video Download Helper. So now we want to add on the adapter application. So you click on the little box at the right there that says Premium. And you open up Firefox again, click on the Video Download Helper icon up in the upper right-hand corner, and I've shown a blown-up version of the icon here in the bottom right of the screen. And you click on the Settings icon in the bottom of the box that pops up. In what pops up there, you click on Companion App Not Installed, and then you'll get this stuff down here, and you click on Install Companion App, and you get some instructions. Now you can just install the unlicensed version if you just want to try all this stuff out and live with the QR code and the other limitations, or you can buy a license at the time by following the instructions that come up. And we'll also see some of this in the next few slides. So let's say you've got the free version of the adapter app and you decide, okay, after trying it out, you want to buy a license. You open up Firefox. click on the video download helper icon, click on the settings icon, and then in the screen that comes up, you click on get a conversion license. You click on whether you want to pay in euros or US dollars, and you follow the instructions. Now, a lot of places are trying to get away from PayPal because PayPal charges exorbitant rates for using them. So in this case, the payment is handled by Stripe, which is sort of a PayPal competitor. So if you're not already a Stripe user, you need to have your credit card handy. And then once you complete the purchase, they'll email you a license number. And then in the screen that comes up, you register an existing license and follow the instructions that come up on entering your license number. Okay, so now we've got Video Download Helper and the Converter app installed. So let's have a quick look at the basics of using it. You open up Firefox, then you open up YouTube, and then you go to the video you want to download. Now, once you get the video playing, and this is after all the opening advertisements that are there to annoy you, you click on the Video Download Helper icon in the upper right of the screen, and you get a pop-up in the upper right. And there'll be several selections on this. And here's a blow up of that box. Sometimes you only get the one thing, the video itself. Other times you get several different selections because you've got the video stream, the audio stream, and then the aggregated stream. So basically you want to look at the one with the largest file size. And you see where the yellow arrow is there. Now, in this particular case, for this particular video, the file size is humongous because it's a video for a two and three quarter hour concert. Typical songs are anywhere from 3 to 30 megabytes, depending on the resolution and the quality. Once you click on the selection you want, the menu will disappear. And the video download helper icon in the upper right-hand corner will have a blue box that will display the number of downloads currently in progress. So the first one you click on, you get one. And when the video is finished downloading in the background, a notification will pop up in the lower right corner of the screen for just a few seconds. You can click on the X in the corner to make it disappear, or can just wait a few seconds, it'll disappear on its own. Okay. Now the video will download in the background at whatever your download speed is, minus whatever bandwidth is required for the actual video that's playing. So typically the download takes a lot less time than it takes for the video to finish playing. No matter where you are in the video, when you start the download, the entire video will download. It won't like just download from where you start the download. It'll download the entire video. And if the download hasn't finished before the video finishes, the download will still finish properly as long as you stay on the YouTube site. And that's the one big caveat. You have to do that until the download is complete. However, once you start the download, you can leave the actual video and go to another video and start to download that video too. And that little blue box on the video download helper icon will change from one to two to however many. But you got to keep in mind that since they all share the same bandwidth, the downloads will be slower and slower. Now I've had up to seven downloads happening at the same time. But they were so slow. And again, the caveat, until all the videos are finished downloading, you must stay on the YouTube site. You can check the progress of the downloads by opening up the download menu and clicking on the blue circle in the lower left corner there. The blue circle shows the number of current downloads that are happening. And when you click on the blue circle, you get a list of all the downloads that are happening and what the progress is. In this case, we're all, you know, about three quarters finished, and it'll give you a 75% finished rate and how many seconds left, estimated left to go. Now, if you want to just download the audio portion as an MP3, you bring up the download selection menu, and then on the selection line you want, you move the cursor over to the far right, and a box with an arrow will appear. You click on this box, and just a caveat in doing this, you can as much as you can download several different videos at the same time, you can download either the whole video or just the audio at one time. So if you want to download both, you download the video first, and then once that's complete, then you can go back to the menu and download the audio. So when you click on that box on the right, you get this menu here. And what you want to select is the download and convert line. That will bring up this box here. And then there's a box in the middle of it. And in this case, it says MP3HQ. If it doesn't say MP3HQ or just MP3, click on the arrow on the right side of the box. A menu will pop up. Select MP3 or MP3HQ. And then the box will settle down to that, and you click on save, and the download will begin. Now, the downloads themselves should be in the C drive users, and whatever your username is, DW Helper directory. And when you first set up Video Download Helper, and it'll create this directory. Now, maybe on your particular computer, it'll pop up somewhere else, but you can have a look around and find it. Now, once you download a file, you might want to rename it right away to something that makes sense to you, because sometimes the names that Video Download Helper gives it are a bit nonsensical or they're not in the correct order. And one of the things you might want to look at is a standard naming convention for music, audio, and video files is artist name, song title, parentheses, the album name or the concert name or whatever other metadata you want, and sometimes the source of the file, and then the file type, which is like an MP3 or M4A or MP4 or whatever. Now, the next slide has more information on this, and I'm not going to speak to this. You can download it and read it, and if you have any questions, we can ask it at a future session or whatever. Now, I'll just give a caveat here. The audio parts of the videos can range from, you know, very widely in quality and in the sound level. And they're not necessarily tagged. And tagged is within the MP3, there's a section where all the metadata is stored. So your music player will show stuff like the artist name and the song name and maybe a picture of the artist or a picture of the album cover. Now, you can fix the sound level and the tagging yourself, and we're going to cover tagging in a few more episodes here. Or you can get the audio from a different source that's much more consistent. Now, it's because it's quite annoying when you're playing the audios that you've gotten from videos, and one is very, very soft and sort of muddy and blah, blah, blah. And the next one is like 10 times the volume and just screams at you and knocks you out of your seat. So when you download tunes from iTunes or some of the other sources, the sound level is consistent. The quality is quite consistent. They're nice and clear. And one other thing to note is that you can get the same song on iTunes in various versions. And again, it can vary widely in quality. If you get the one off iTunes, it's the official video or whatever, official video HQ, it's usually pretty good. And as much as Video Download Helper with the converter app can convert videos to a different video format while you're downloading, or convert videos that you've already got on your computer to a different format, it's not really good at this. And so I highly recommend that you use other video computers. And there's some on the next slide there. I went to one of those articles, you know, the best video converters for Windows 10. And I just copied out, they listed 12 of them there. And with each one, they list the good and the bad and the ugly for it. And then if you click on the actual title, it'll go to the article and tell you a lot more about it. Now, I've put the arrow against this NCH's Prism video converter software. I've used it. And the big thing about it is it's beginner friendly. So it doesn't take a lot to be able to figure it out. And it comes with a decent no-cost version as well as the paid version. And this whole story on the converters, the URL is listed at the bottom of the page there. Okay, so the next session we're going to cover how to download or capture videos using Daveview Video Capture and Screen Recorder software. And this is how you get all those videos that you can't download with the Video Download Helper. From all the sites that don't want you to download the videos. And then coming later, there's a bunch of other stuff we'll be covering. And that's it for tonight.
Thanks. Thanks, Bob. There are a couple of comments. Tom notes that Premium Helper is now $28.50 US. And Tim says he's used a free program called AVS Video Converter, and it converts all the main video formats and file sizes. And there's also an equivalent program, AVS Audio Converter, that will convert various audio file formats.
Yeah, there's all sorts of converters out there. Usually what I do when I'm looking for a new type of software is I Google on best whatever the type of software is, and usually get several different selections there. Look through those and see what's there. And one of the things I look for is some consistency. If you look at 10 different versions of the best whatever it is type of software, and you see the same two or three on every list, then those are the ones you want to zero in on. The instructions I just gave for how to download and install, I did those about a week ago. And I said the Video Download Helper is free. The converter ranges in price. I've seen it high, I've seen it low, so. It depends on the day of the week and the tides and the phases of the moon and all those other wonderful things.
Serge Eric says he's used another program, Minitool YouTube Downloader. It has an integrated converter to convert videos to the format of your choice, but doesn't offer metadata options. Okay, thanks, Bob. Well, we look forward to more on that for you from later on. So we're at that time. We have a few minutes left over on our proverbial hour. If anybody has any other questions that we haven't covered in the chat, put something in the chat, or you can probably unmute yourself and ask the question.
Something for Alan. I know that many sites that will check if you are a spammer, it will check your reverse IP address. Basically, normally you type your IP address and it goes to a website. The reverse IP address is it will take your domain name and create, generate, will tell you what is your actual IP address of your mail server address. So just a possibility, and that might help. I don't know.
Okay, thanks, Josh. I'll try that out. Chris, do you want to mention the question about Google warning messages?
I assume most people probably have come across this. So Lorraine had a question. She got an email message on the phone regarding a new sign into Google account and asked to click on check activity, and should she click on that? Never had it before. The way that this works with Google is that if they notice a new sign into your account from either a new computer or a new browser on the same computer, you'll end up getting one of these notifications. And it's just a warning that if you didn't do it, then you probably should look into this to see what it is that it might be an attacker or something like that who has managed to get your credentials is essentially what it comes down to. So if you did recently log in using a different computer or a different browser on the same computer into any Google property that requires an authentication or login to it, then it's worth checking out. Personally, these things are pretty common. I mean, it could be faked, theoretically. So you should definitely see where it's going to take you. But you can always go there manually if you just go to accounts, plural.google.com and sign in there if you are requested to sign in. If you're already using a browser, it's logged into Gmail or something, you probably won't be prompted to log in. And then you can look in the left-hand bar. There'll be a security option, and you can look for recent security events. And it will list that thing that they sent you a notice about. It'll show there was a new login from, and you can expand the details about that and see if it makes sense to you. If not, if it doesn't make sense to you, then quite frankly, I would change your password. Because it definitely could be an indication of an attack on your account. And so if you can get in and you can change your password, I would do so at that point in time. But only if you don't recognize it as being, you know, it'll have the date and time that it occurred, and it'll have the IP address and the browser that was used. So if it all makes sense to you, then that's all good and well. But if it doesn't make sense to you, then I would take action on it. And the action I would take is to change my password at Google.
And you actually said new computer, and you also said different computer. And I think it's really different computer, because
yes,
I see that all the time when I'm using
my
laptop, my desktop, my smartphone, Linux, Windows. And I get these "was it you" type messages all the time.
Can I expand on this?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I just checked on that, and the first activity was when I joined you guys. and then what happened is I got a message from Zoom saying that my 40 minutes were done, and it cut me out, and then I lost the connection. And so then the connection came back. I logged in again. I got another notification about asking, is that you? Or is that we noticed some activity? And the time jived with what I was doing. When my internet connection came back and I was able to log in to the meeting again. So this is really strange. It's the first time that happens to me. So that's why I was sort of wondering what was going on. So what do you think? Should I go and go to trouble and change my password?
You shouldn't be prompted to for credential your Google credentials going on to a Zoom meeting. You shouldn't have a 40-minute time limit either, because we're using it's you're connecting to somebody else's meeting, and we're using Pro account, which doesn't have any time limits on it. So I don't know why you would have gotten anything ending after 40 minutes. That doesn't make sense to me at all. Alan, does it make sense to you?
No, I don't understand how you can, if you're logging onto our link,
there's no other authentication at all.
That's bizarre.
Yeah. So I don't know what's causing that. And I don't know why it would be referencing to your Google account at all.
I was having trouble this week with Zoom too. I have a free account. But the people, I had to be signed on and ready to go, or nobody even got the message, just, you know, wait for the person to start the meeting. They were saying, this is no meeting, it's invalid meeting. But as soon as I logged on to the Zoom meeting, then they got a valid message, but so they could come in. But so now, lesson learned, I'm going to sign on, you know, 10 minutes ahead if it's my personal account.
Actually, what will happen with that, Linda, is that I presume you're using either a personal meeting, or so there's no schedule associated with it. So they're not going to be able to tell them, oh, the meeting's going to start in 10 minutes because it's not scheduled.
Yeah, but they'll say like it starts in 2024 or something like that.
Yeah, if you schedule it, it will give them notice about when the meeting will actually start. Okay. But if you don't have it scheduled, they'll just say it doesn't exist. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Lorraine, do you have a Zoom account? And did you log on to that and then somehow find our meeting?
I just clicked on the link that you had sent through the email, the last email that you sent.
Okay,
that
yeah.
Well, so I clicked on that, and it was fine for maybe, I don't know, until maybe 10 to 8 or something like that. Then I got this thing about Zoom. But you say you're not using Zoom? Is that what you're saying?
Well, we are, but we're using a Zoom Pro account, and it's when you're connecting to somebody else's meeting, time limits only apply if the person running the meeting is using a free account. And in that case, it's limited to 40 minutes. But we're using a Zoom Pro account, so there is no time limit on it. And so you should be able to just connect, and you wouldn't get the termination at all. I don't know why.
You shouldn't get the termination.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know. And then I lost my internet connection after that as well. So anyway, when I logged back in again, the times that I logged in with my computer jived, like it was okay. So anyway, so I had the option to say it wasn't me, but I think it was me. So I didn't want to say it wasn't me, and then all hell breaks loose, and I don't know what the hell they're doing. So
yeah, if you say it wasn't me, they're going to end up giving you advice on, well, your account might be compromised, here's what you can do about it. That they won't lock your account or anything like that. They just want to give you advice on how to protect yourself if you think that it wasn't you. But if the time jives with the last time you logged in to Gmail or some other Google service that requires authentication, then I wouldn't be overly concerned about it. If you go to accounts.google.com and take a look and see if everything looks like it makes sense there, in the left-hand bar, look for security, and then in the right-hand side, there'll be recent security events, and it'll show when your account was accessed and from what computer, and you know, things like that. So it's probably worth looking at that just to see if anything really throws up a red flag, that, you know, this was a login from a Linux computer, you know, or something like totally unrecognizable, you know, or an IP address that happens to come from China or something like that. I don't know. You know, you need to worry about it. But if it looks like it makes sense, then I wouldn't be overly concerned about it.
Okay, and my IP address, is that always the same address whenever I'm at home?
Most high-speed connections, you will end up with a long lease on your IP address. What you can do to see, certainly it shouldn't change really recently. So if you go to myipaddress.com, it will tell you what your public IP address is, which is actually the address of your internet router. Myipaddress.com is one of the sites that will tell you what your public IP address is. And if that jives, when you go to accounts.google.com and you look up the recent activities and it's always showing that IP address, then I wouldn't worry about it.
Okay, thank you.
Contact my
heart palpitations are going away now.
Contact me by email if you chris.taylor@opcug.ca. If you have any questions, contact me. I could do a remote assist to your computer, and we could look at things a little bit closer if you want, and to help put your mind at ease that things are okay.
And maybe it's just a one-off internet glitch, and next week you'll log on using the link and it'll be fine. So
it might be. But by all means, contact me if you want, and we can spend a little bit of time going over it together.
Okay. Thank you very much for your help.
Okay.
Okay. So a couple of thanks, notices. As Chris mentioned, next week is our regular club meeting. And we have this presentation by Gillian Villeneuve and the Macintosh user group on me and my Mac. And my Mac is a MacBook Pro. So Gillian's going to be talking about MacBook Pros. And because of that, next week there will not be a Q&A as usual. We just have the regular meeting. So our next Q&A will be on May the 18th. So if you have questions or things that you want to share, send them along and we'll slot you into the agenda. And then finally, also as Chris mentioned, our next Tech Talk, the third one in the series, is on June the 6th. And this is Lawrence talking about scam avoidance. And you do need to register so that we can send you the logon credentials. But for OPCUG members, their registration is complimentary. So just send us an email and we'll sign you up. And that's it for tonight. So thanks everyone for attending. A lot of good information, I hope, and we'll see you next week at the regular meeting, and Q&A, we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Thanks, folks.